We are in the condition we are in the state of ignorance we are in the state of war, in the state of economic depression, in the state of depletion of the resources of our planet because of the greed of psychopaths who thought they could create their own reality. Well, look at the reality they created.
You're listening to The Truth Perspective on the Soft Radio Network, the world for people who think.
Today is Sunday, June 25th, and welcome to The Truth Perspective, everyone. I'm your host, Elon Martin, and joining me in the studio today is Harrison Keeley.
Hello.
And from across the pond, we have Joe Quinn.
Hi there.
Today, we're happy to have Dr. Michael Sala on the show to discuss his book, Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower, UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's assassination. Michael Sala has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and was an assistant professor researcher in residence in the School of International Service, American University, from 1996 to 2004. He now has a website called exopolitics.com and is the author of such books as Exopolitics. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. Aloha to everyone.
Aloha. Well, let's just jump right in. You piece together some very compelling information from a lot of good sources in your book, Kennedy's Last Stand. And I suppose a good place to start would be with MJ-12, or the Majestic 12, as it's known. Can you tell us about how this group got started, what their mandate was, who it was comprised of, and the types of things they did? And how do we know these things about MJ-12? What evidence do we have that they existed as a group and actually carried out the activities that that we believe they did, Michael?
Sure. Well, there are a number of documents that point to the creation of MJ-12 in September of 1947, and that it was President Truman who authorized the creation, and he worked with the Secretary of Defense, who at the time was James Forrestal, and also he worked with Vannevar Bush, who was the chief scientist under both President Roosevelt and Truman during the Second World War. And basically Majestic 12 was set up exclusively to focus on all of the issues and the policies concerning extraterrestrial life and technologies that had come into the possession of the U.S. Military, both during the Second World War and immediately after, in events like the Roswell crash and Aztec in 1948. And really it is a committee that is very important for understanding the big picture for how policy is set on this whole issue of extraterrestrial life and technology. And as we go through the history of MJ-12, we see that its policies have been mainly oriented towards keeping all of this information highly classified, restricting access to only a very small group within the U.S. military-industrial complex, where only select individuals would be given access, and all of the others, no matter how senior they are in the system, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, the heads of congressional committees, four-star generals or admirals, these people would be excluded if it wasn't deemed that they had need-to-know access.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of the reason it was set up that way, you explain, is to kind of protect the office of the presidency and other parts of the government in case something went awry. So ostensibly, this is the kind of the dark world of politics, and it was compartmentalized and separated from the publicly acknowledged bodies of government and policies that that were allowed to be spoken of in public forums.
Well, that's right. Yes, it was definitely something that was set up so that the president could delegate authority on these issues and the policies that were required to pursue various projects concerning extraterrestrial life and technology with the required experts, and to compartmentalize it all so that way you wouldn't have different branches of the US government or the military demanding access. I mean, that was really the kind of the big problem that this kind of information and the technology that was being studied was so revolutionary that if too many people got access, the information would be something that couldn't be controlled. And I think from the very beginning of the creation of MJ-12, I think they understood that this was information that could not be shared widely throughout the U.S. National security system, simply because the need to study and reverse engineer these technologies, put them into application, while at the same time feigning ignorance that such technologies existed and kind of poo-pooing the whole UFO phenomenon. So that was what MJ-12 did, and I think that over the decades they've been very effective at it.
Well, Michael, I just want to go back a little bit to the documents and the documentation for all this and make a couple comments on the book. First of all, like Ilan said, I think it is a compelling case that you make. And I just, for our listeners, I want to just describe a little bit of the way in which you do it, because I believe it was in the 80s that a lot of the leaked, we'll call them alleged MJ-12 documents for now, first came out, and there have been, the documents that have been leaked to UFO researchers in the years since. And so there's been a controversy among people in the UFO field over whether they're legit or hoaxed or anything like that. And one of the things that I think is interesting and good about your book is that on the one hand, you kind of take some pretty good analysis of these documents by like the Woods, for example, and Stanton Friedman, who think that a lot of these documents have a high probability of being genuine. But at the same time, what you do is you weave them in with officially acknowledged documents and history. And I think that's what makes the case kind of compelling for me. I mean, I kind of consider myself more of an open-minded skeptic when it comes to a lot of these things, because I think a lot of them can't necessarily be proven, but I, you know, I'm willing to accept when a story makes sense at the very least. So, about this trajectory of that, when MJ-12 was supposed to have started in the end of 1947, I think the kind of chronology that you paint of this, the development of this group is very interesting, because, like you said, there's this compartmentalized factor to it. And when you look at how it was originally set up, according to these documents, it was, correct me if I'm wrong, it was originally set up by Truman, and he essentially gave himself control over it. So MJ-12 was supposed to report directly to him. And very soon after that, it looks as if the people involved kind of came to the conclusion that that wasn't necessarily a good choice for their purposes, because administrations change, and if a hostile administration, or one that they thought was maybe incompetent or wouldn't do the right thing, came into power, they would kind of lose their edge or their control over their goals and what they wanted to do. So that kind of delegated the authority and put it more close or more exclusively into the hands of the individuals that were part of this organization, and then it just spiraled even further from there. So I was wondering if you could describe that process of the development of this group further away from the official levers of power, so to speak.
Right. Well, yes, it is a very important history, and I think most political systems have bureaucrats and committees that deal with public policy issues who are lifelong members of the civil service. And so, you know, often these are the committee and the people that presidents or political representatives will delegate to for, you know, for policy advice. And so it's not unusual that Truman did this, that he set up a committee that would basically give him policy advice on how to handle these issues. And that as time moved on, you know, as different administrations came in and out, you know, this committee of people comprising bureaucrats, senior officials in the military, senior scientists, that they would see themselves as having the kind of long-term association with these issues, that they could better come up with the appropriate policy. So at some point, you know, that that distinction between giving policy advice to making policy, that that was what was crossed, that this MJ-12 committee ceased to be a committee that merely gave the president policy advice on dealing with these issues, to where it became the committee that actually made the policy on these issues. Exactly when that happened, I think there's been a historic evolution of how Truman set it up. Eisenhower struggled with the MJ-12 committee, that there's a few people that have come forward, whistleblowers, that say that he had, you know, big problems with the MJ-12 committee, and even threatened to invade Area 51 with the U.S. Army stationed in Colorado. And that under Kennedy, we see this this actually coming into full-blown conflict, where you have a president basically saying to the MJ-12 committee, hey, you guys, you've got to report to me, give me all the information, and this is where policy is made, and the MJ-12 committee basically you know, saying no, you know, we're the ones that make policy, and you know, you shouldn't interfere in something that you don't have a need to know. And so this is, you know, really what my book goes into, that Kennedy believed that the office of the president needed to be well in the loop on this issue and actually involved in the policy making, and not just leave it to this unelected committee to make policy.
Well, Michael, there are, as you were intimating, there were all these kinds of developments and stages and relationships that MJ-12 kind of spiraled away from or moved away from since its inception. And you set up a lot of this by introducing, you mentioned him a little earlier, James Forrestal, who was originally Secretary of the U.S. Navy and would a few years later become the U.S. Secretary of Defense under President Truman. And he became part of MJ-12 and was also kind of crucial to Kennedy's understanding of an involvement with the reality of the UFOs and the aliens. So I wonder if you can get into Forrestal a little bit, what happened in 1949 with Forrestal. Because I kind of see his participation and what happened as a kind of foreshadowing of things to come in some sense. So I wonder if you can discuss that a little bit.
Sure. That's actually, Forrestal is the critical figure in all of this. As he was the Undersecretary of the U.S. Navy from 1940 to 44, then he was the Navy Secretary from 44 to 47, and then the Secretary of Defense. And the Navy was really the lead agency when it came to this whole phenomenon of extraterrestrial life and technology and studying it. And Forrestal, from the very beginning, was involved in basically all the data that the U.S. military had been gathering on extraterrestrial life. The Los Angeles air raid incident, for example, A number of Majestic documents point to that, involving the retrieval of a crashed flying saucer, and that a group, an interagency group involving the Navy, the U.S. Army Air Force, and some of the leading aircraft companies actually got together to study this phenomenon. So Forrestal, from the very beginning, was involved in that. He was the one that proposed the Operation Paperclip because he was getting a lot of intelligence. This is something that I've more recently learned about a Navy intelligence program that was set up where the Navy spies were reporting back to the U.S. Navy's San Diego facility, Naval Air Station, about German aerospace programs during the Second World War. So Forrestal was getting all this information. And so with the conclusion of the war, he was the one that recommended Project Operation Paperclip. And he actually traveled over to Germany immediately after the Second World War. This was in July and August, to basically oversee some of the German technologies that were very advanced, that had some kind of connection to this extraterrestrial phenomenon, to the technologies that had been reported that the Germans were developing. And Forrestal took Kennedy, who at the time was just a really just beginning to write articles, and as a kind of freelance writer, he was a book author, and Kennedy was taken by Forrestal as his personal guest because Forrestal wanted to recruit Kennedy to his personal staff. Mm-hmm. And so Kennedy had direct access to the technologies, the high-level military officials and political discussions that were all taking place in Germany at the time, involving Operation Paperclip, and Kennedy learned from Forrestal what was going on, got to saw these things, he got to write about it in his diary, and his diary was posthumously published. And later on, when Kennedy decided that he would enter politics rather than joining Forrestal in the Navy, then Kennedy continued to be briefed by Forrestal, who went on to become a key official within the MJ-12 committee. And so Forrestal was very unhappy with the way MJ-12 was setting policies and the policies it had adopted with Truman's blessing. And so Forrestal was telling Kennedy all of this, and that kind of sets the background for what happened later.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Kennedy himself during the war was involved in naval intelligence, right?
That's right, yes. Kennedy, during the time of the Los Angeles air raid, where some of these Majestic documents actually describe U.S. Navy intelligence getting possession of a disc that crashed off the coast of Los Angeles, that this was something that Kennedy was exposed to because he was actually working with U.S. Navy intelligence at the time.
Mm-hmm. So right from the very beginning of his kind of, well, public and private career in the military, he seems to have been kind of in the right place at the right time for when we like look back, you know, in retrospect, having like all these alleged documents. It strikes me as either very coincidental or just the truth that that he would have been at the very least he was in these places in the right time to have received this information. And then the link with Forrestal, I wasn't aware of that before I read your book. And that kind of jumped off the page at me that, so not only was Kennedy involved with naval intelligence, but Forrestal was right there, you know, basically running at the top of the Navy. And and they were friends. And at the further on in the book, you point out that I believe it was 1963, was it May, that Kennedy made a public, trip to Forrestal's grave. And so photos were taken. I thought that was very interesting. So there was, that just shows that they had a relationship. They were close on some level, And like you said, of course, you know, Forrestal was trying to recruit Kennedy. So then, so that kind of provides the backdrop for almost 20 years later, 15 years later, when Kennedy becomes president. But maybe we could get into a little bit more about Forrestal, and because his death is very mysterious, right? So maybe we could get into that, and what leads up to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Well, Forrestal, you know, his background, he was Irish Catholic, a very successful businessman. And he was actual personal friends with Joe Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father, who was also Irish Catholic and also very successful. But they were outside of the kind of establishment, the WASP community, the ones that really held power. And so Kennedy and Forrestal, even though they were both very successful, you know, they would kind of like be more, we would regard them today as kind of more in the Democratic political side or the Democratic spectrum, as we know the Kennedy family was. And so they were essentially big believers in the idea of a kind of merit-based system where the best people, you know, they're allowed to rise to the top and have, you know, the kind of influence they deserve because of their own personal skills and abilities. Whereas the establishment operated on the principle of, you know, the old boys network, you know, who you know is more important than what you know. And so this was something that both Forrestal and Kennedy, they were really opposed to that. You know, they really did want to have the best people involved at all levels of government. And so when it got to this secrecy system that had been implemented concerning all of these advanced technologies that the US military had recovered or was in the process of recovering and that the Germans were secretly developing, Forrestal's mindset was much more focused on, okay, let's get the best people involved in studying these technologies and seeing, you know, what the appropriate policy should be, but we need to kind of like circulate this so that we give access to the right people. Whereas the many of the members of the MJ-12 committee who were kind of more aligned with that kind of you know, the New England establishment, that kind of WASP mindset of, you know, the old boys network, you know, their view was, well, you know, here's some really really advanced technologies. Let's kind of like see how this can help us with you know, our agenda. And the idea was that you would just give access to people that were part of your network, and it wasn't, what was important was who you knew rather than how much you knew. And so it really was a process whereby, you know, it really was excluding the best people from having this kind of access. And so this was the policy struggle between Forrestal and others within the Majestic 12 Committee that really did want to restrict access to just a very few. And Forrestal, you know, having a business background himself, realized that it really was the kind of military industrial community that was wanting to monopolize these kinds of technologies and to develop them for their own benefit. And so he was very much opposed to that and struggled against that. And eventually that was what led to him being ousted as Secretary of Defense by Truman in 1949 in March. And then 2 months later, basically being killed simply because he wasn't going to give up, that even as a private citizen, he was still going to basically reveal what was going on, you know, brief people like Kennedy and others about the true situation.
Mm. And as so, you explain, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, Forrestal's death, yeah, it's kind of suspicious, pretty suspicious on the face of it, considering all the details that he was, you know, diagnosed with depression or whatever, and then put in the 16th floor of the hospital in the VIP suite, you know, and then he decides to jump out, you know, and but there's a lot more to it than that. But basically, it's very suspicious, his death, obviously, given who he was. And but is there anything, Michael, other than the MJ-12 business that you've come across that could have led him to be kind of have fallen out of favor with people in positions of kind of power in the U.S.?
That was the issue that really kind of got my attention, that, you know, there was something that, you know, led to him having a major policy dispute with the Truman administration. And he certainly, you know, to me, I think that is the most plausible explanation, that he kind of differed in some fundamental policy area with Truman and others, and this is what led to his ouster. There was, because I think at the time, you know, people were shocked because Forrestal really was regarded as a national hero because of what he had done during the war. So, you know, for him to be sacked like that by Truman, you know, this was kind of like major news at the time. And, you know, there wasn't any other major policy issue that kind of really struck me that could have led to him being killed like that. And I do want to point out, pardon me, that Forrestal, while he was in that hospital suite, was visited by a number of people associated with MJ-12, and one of them in particular was very important, and that was Lyndon Baron Johnson, that he actually was one of the people that visited Forrestal in the hospital suite shortly before Forrestal's murder. And in the book, I actually make the case that I think Johnson was part of that.
Right. Yeah, certainly. I can't imagine. I can't imagine there would be anything. I can't imagine any other policy disagreement with the Truman government that would lead someone to want to kill Forrestal. You know, anything so significant that they would take those measures. The only thing that really fits is if it's got to do with some information about, you know, alien technology or whatever, something in that domain. I mean, assuming that information was available at the time, the idea that someone would be inclined to leak it to the public or at least spread the information more widely beyond a small group of people would be reason enough for those people to want to get rid of the person wanting to do that.
Exactly, and you know, that Forrestal being a kind of national hero and you know, Secretary of Defense, the first one, and being sacked in such a way, and then being killed off shortly afterwards, kind of showed just how powerful the Majestic 12 Committee was, because, you know, if they could arrange for a sitting Secretary of Defense to be sacked and then 2 months later kind of killed off in mysterious circumstances, then, you know, that was sending a signal. And, you know, this is something that I think, you know, people that knew Forrestal well, and Kennedy was one of them. Kennedy knew what was going on because he continued to see Forrestal. They were personal friends. And, you know, in the book, I actually have a document there that shows Forrestal and Kennedy continued to communicate when Kennedy was a congressman. And, you know, you referred earlier on to that photograph that showed President Kennedy at the grave of James Forrestal in May of 1963. You know, what's significant about that photo was that was taken 1 week before Kennedy went to Holloman Air Force Base, White Sands Missile Range, and there's another kind of very important military industrial facility there. And basically, this was where Kennedy was going to be confronting the kind of German scientists who were very much involved in the secrecy system that had been set up, that you know, these German scientists that were involved in these very secretive projects at that kind of at that very important facility there, Holloman Air Force Base and White Sands, that this was really Kennedy's effort to try to get access to a lot of this information. And I think that the fact that, you know, he visited Forrestal's grave a week before, to me signified that, you know, he was more or less kind of like almost like paying homage to the man who had tried to do something similar before, but had failed. But, you know, Kennedy, I think, really believed that, you know, as president, that he was, you know, had the power to be able to do what Forrestal had failed to do. But, you know, as events turned out, we see that that wasn't the case.
Well, I want us to get into Eisenhower a little bit, because he plays very strongly into this whole story. Dwight D. Eisenhower, as we know, was a very important general during World War II. He knew a lot about what was going on as well. He went into a kind of a role as a president of a university for a while, you mentioned in your book, Michael. And then in 1953, he runs for president and becomes president. And he is trying to understand what the situation as regards to MJ-12 is. And although it's outside of the scope of your book, you have a very interesting analysis of Eisenhower's role in all this in an essay you wrote called Eisenhower's 1954 Meeting with Extraterrestrials. And I think it speaks greatly to some things that happened later on with Eisenhower, and in particular, as you mentioned in your book, his discussions with Kennedy about the whole UFO secrecy and MJ-12 situation. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that essay, Eisenhower's 1954 Meeting with Extraterrestrials, and just describe basically what that's about and how it fits in with all of this.
Sure. Well, that meeting that occurred in I think it was February 20th of 1954, where President Eisenhower secretly traveled to Edwards Air Force Base, where he had an encounter with a delegation of extraterrestrials. That this was something that has long been rumored. You know, there's a lot of kind of circumstantial evidence supporting Eisenhower actually doing something very secretive at Edwards Air Force Base. You know, for example, he was down at Palm Springs at that time. He did go missing for a night. You know, a cover story that he went to see a dentist was shown to be false. There are military records showing that Edwards Air Force Base for a period of 3 days was closed down at that time when Eisenhower was in the area. Mm-hmm. And then there were a number of whistleblowers that have come forward who have described what they saw, and essentially what they saw was Eisenhower having an encounter with delegates from some extraterrestrial civilization. That's what many of these whistleblower sources have reported. And so, you know, to me, this is the first in what was a series of meetings that Eisenhower had. I know that there was another one that he had a year later at Holloman Air Force Base, which again, you know, there's a number of whistleblowers. There's circumstantial evidence supporting that Eisenhower did actually travel out to Holloman Air Force Base secretly in February of 1955 and had a similar type encounter with some extraterrestrial visitors. So there are two incidents early in his administration where he was having some kind of diplomatic interaction with these visitors.
Yeah, and what's so interesting, also, I mean, you know, it's kind of a mind-blowing thing to accept that Eisenhower or any sitting president actually had meetings with extraterrestrials in which certain agreements may have been discussed or treaties have been agreed to. I think what makes your essay and analysis of the whole meeting so compelling is the kind of, it's not only the number of whistleblowers that like Bill Cooper and John Lear and others who are well known to be connected to intelligence and military circles, but you also include descriptions of the meeting by Gerald Light and others that kind of get to the heart of the psychological reality of Eisenhower and others, representatives of religious groups and economic groups, small contingent meeting with these other worldly beings, and what their feelings about it were. So it makes a compelling case for it, even if it sounds fantastic and unbelievable on the surface of it. I think you make a very good case for the idea that these meetings had actually occurred. And can we say a little bit about what the outcome of them were in terms of agreements that may or may not have occurred between elements of Eisenhower's group and the ETs that he met with?
Sure. Well, you know, we've had quite a number of people who have come forward, whistleblowers, that have discussed working in projects where they have seen extraterrestrials working alongside American scientists and engineers in reverse engineering certain technologies. Charles Hall is one that I think is particularly important. He was at Nellis Air Force Base in 1964, and he basically described what had emerged from these agreements that had been reached by Eisenhower in terms of the kind of full-blown cooperation between one group of extraterrestrials that he called the Tall Whites and the U.S. Air Force, where the Tall Whites were helping them develop advanced technologies, flying saucer craft and so forth. Another whistleblower, Bill Uhouse, he also was an engineer, and he described the process whereby he and other engineers who would be working on a reverse engineering program, if they got stuck, then they would bring in an extraterrestrial consultant, and he would help them. That ET would help these engineers understand these kinds of technologies. So there's lots of stories like that of these whistleblowers having some kind of knowledge of agreements that had been reached whereby extraterrestrials would be helped, would be in some way given access to U.S. facilities and resources, and they would and the U.S. would receive help in the terms of kind of technical assistance on developing and reverse engineering some of these advanced technologies.
But you also write that along with this assistance that was given by at least some of these groups of extraterrestrials, that there was also a kind of agreement to permit the Greys or other groups to do research on human beings, and this kind of opened the door, it seems, to a whole other avenue of exploitation that perhaps Eisenhower feared felt powerless to do anything about. So would you say that's a correct assessment?
Yes, I think that is something that we can say that this is what various whistleblowers have reported. There's one in particular, Dan Sherman, who worked for the U.S. Air Force and was stationed at the NSA for a period of time. That he said that he actually his job for the NSA that the covert assignment he had been given was to monitor the number of people that were being abducted by these extraterrestrials and pass that information on to the proper US authorities. And right there you have evidence that there had been an agreement reached where a certain number of abductions would be allowed or where the US authorities would expect to receive information from the extraterrestrials as to how many people were being abducted and what was being done to them and so forth. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Bill Cooper and others have talked about at length in terms of this being one of the more egregious aspects of this kind of secret agreement.
Egregious indeed. And, it's interesting. Eisenhower seemed to be, if not kind of in the loop in 1954 and 1955 with these meetings, at least kind of aware of, to some degree, what was going on. And then, as you described earlier, he felt so out of the loop at another point in time, I think it was 1958, that he actually threatened MJ-12, and I believe they were at S-4 base near Area 51, with the use of the military, that he would actually command a group in the Army to come in there and forcefully take over, just so Eisenhower could kind of get a grasp on the situation, because presumably he was left more and more out of the loop and wasn't provided with any kind of updates or developments, status reports for those few years. And so he had the power to do this. And what he ends up doing, I think you describe in either your essay or your book, is he sends a group of a couple of CIA people who are newly recruited to go to Area 51 and come back with a status report in lieu of attacking Area 51. Does that sound about right?
Right, yes. And we need to always keep in mind that Area 51 actually has two secret facilities there. The facility that has the alien-related projects and extraterrestrial visitors is at the S-4 facility, and that's where Eisenhower demanded that he gets a full briefing on what is occurring there, because he knew that that was really where the action was, that, what was happening at the Groom Lake facility, which most people assume to be, associate that with Area 51. These are cover programs. You're talking about the U-2 spy plane or the SR-71. These are cover programs, that the real secret programs are happening at the S-4 facility. And so Eisenhower had threatened, the U.S. Army intervention into Area 51 because he wasn't getting the information, and he knew, as anyone who operated at that level knew, is that if you're not getting the information, then you're not part of the policymaking process, because only people who have access to that information are going to be able to have input into, what are the appropriate policies, which is why security access is so important. This whole kind of, people often, this might be just an academic argument in terms of, who has security access and who doesn't. Well, it actually has a very profound policy implication, because people who have the clearance they're going to be part of any policy making that occurs because they have the need to know clearance to be able to give informed opinions about, you know, what should be the policy. But people who don't have that need to know access, regardless of their rank, they could be a four-star general, they can be the president, it can be anyone. If they don't have need to know, then, you know, they're not going to be part of the policy-making process. And Eisenhower knew this, and so he was furious that he was being cut out of the loop and therefore not being allowed to be part of the policy-making process. That was a major turnaround from the way in which Majestic 12 had initially been set up to advise the president on appropriate policies. Now the president was cut out of the loop and MJ-12 was making the policies. So Eisenhower found that unacceptable, and so he had to make his threats to get access.
My quick question, I can't remember, what was the source for that story about Eisenhower threatening Area 51? Can you recall?
Sure. Yes. That was a whistleblower that Linda Moulton Howe had first come into contact with, when was it, about 12 years ago. And she did a number of interviews with him, and then he essentially was threatened, and so he went off the radar for about a dozen years. Then he kind of did an interview with Richard Dolan that was shown at the Citizens Hearing Conference in 2013 now. I mean, it's been a few years now. Mm-hmm. So that kind of put him back on the map in terms of you know, what he had said. And there had been another whistleblower, a colonel for the U.S. Army. He was in the JAG Officer Corps. And he worked for the White. He was in the White House.
Just hold on one sec, Michael. We're getting the connection is breaking up a little bit. Let me just. Can you just say something? We'll see if the connection is good.
Okay. Right. Well, I was talking about Eisenhower being. Okay. So Stephen Lufkin, he was at the time, this is in the late 1950s, 58 and so forth, he was actually working with the White House Signal Corps, and so he remembers having conversations with Eisenhower, and he remembers Eisenhower talking about the UFO topic and saying that Eisenhower was very unhappy with the way in which the issue was being handled. He said that the best people were excluded from having access to this kind of information and that he was unhappy about that. And, you know, and I just kind of want to bring that back to the earlier comments I made about Forrestal, that Forrestal had that same mindset where, you know, the best people needed to be given access to this kind of technology so that you could have the best policies formulated. So Eisenhower, you know, a decade later, has a conflict with Majestic 12. The same group was responsible for Forrestal's death. You have a similar conflict now with President Eisenhower. And in this case, the MJ-12 committee backed down. They gave Eisenhower the access, but Eisenhower knew what was going on. And so that's, you know, those are the two principal kind of whistleblowers that talked about Eisenhower at the time, because they personally say that they spoke with him, knew what he was thinking. And then, of course, we have the famous farewell address from January 17, 1961, mm-hmm. You know, where Eisenhower clearly was very unhappy with the way in which the military-industrial complex was running things, and he clearly felt that, you know, it had become a rogue entity outside of the control of the office of the president. And so, you know, we know there that Eisenhower was definitely unhappy about something. But I think what he told Kennedy privately is more important in terms of understanding why 3 years later Kennedy was assassinated.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe to as a way of kind of moving forward to the Kennedy administration, I wanted to just bring up one more point that I found really interesting in the book, and this was from the official sources, and that regard is in regards to Area 51, because for decades it wasn't even officially acknowledged that Area 51 existed, and once it was acknowledged, you have a little excerpt from a declassified document that was released about the kind of history of Area 51, and I believe I can't remember what year was it? Was it 1950 that it opened, or 55?
55.
And how once it was opened, the organization in charge of security was the CIA. And the reason I found this interesting is because, as you point out in the book, prior to 55, when you look at all these like witnesses who have come forward in later years and documents and everything kind of related to this early period of kind of UFO history, kind of Roswell and post-Roswell, it all involves kind of Army bases and Air Force bases. And so this was, I believe, the first facility that wasn't under the like direct command of the military. So it was shunted off to the CIA. And this relates back to MJ-12 because according to the leaked documents, the first kind of head dog of MJ-12 was Roscoe Hillenkoetter, who was the director of Central Intelligence in those early years. And so right at the very beginning, you have this kind of tie-in with the newly created CIA. And then in the 50s, Alan Dulles becomes head of the CIA and presumably, again, according to one of these documents, becomes head of MJ-12. So we've got this situation where initially it kind of relates to what we were discussing earlier about the transition from a committee that was ostensibly under presidential control and then moving further and further away from the kind of official, you know, government hierarchy. And so in that case, we had it moving away from direct presidential control to more of this independent kind of like deep state organization. And in this case, we have, you know, it's the same development whereas previously all these bases and all the locations where this kind of work was presumably being done, there was at least a measure of kind of official hierarchy or control via the military. And so now we have this Area 51 and S4 bases that are pretty much like controlled directly by the CIA. And we've got Alan Dulles in the picture now. So then Kennedy is elected in 60 and becomes president in 61. So maybe just using that as a jumping off point, can you take us into the Kennedy administration and kind of how that developed?
Sure. Well, Kennedy pretty early on tries to work out exactly, you know, what is happening with this whole secrecy system that's been set up around these programs. And at a certain time, he realized that it was all being run by the CIA, that they were the kind of the gatekeeper for all of this. So he contacted the CIA director, Alan Dulles, and sent him a memorandum, a top secret memorandum. So that's one of the leaked Majestic documents. I believe it was dated sometime early June of 1961, and basically asked Dulles for information pertaining to MJ-12 psychological operations. So, you know, that might sound puzzling now, but psychological operations was the kind of cover term for anything related to the UFO phenomenon. And we know that because later Kennedy received a response from Dulles in October of 1961, and this is just a month before Dulles resigns from he gives up his position as a director of the CIA, and he tells Kennedy that that the MJ-12 psychological operations, involve UFO files, and that this is something that has been handled, and that Kennedy doesn't have a need to know. So, you know, here you have an extraordinary document, you know, and of course, you know, the MJ-12 documents are contested, but still you have this document, which quite extraordinarily is where you actually have a sitting CIA director telling President Kennedy, or telling the president, that he doesn't have need to know access to a particular program being run within the government, and to just get lost. Mm-hmm. And so you have another important MJ-12 document, which is the burned memo, and I'll go into the detail of you know, how that came about later, but essentially what happened was that during this entire period, while Kennedy was making inquiries about UFOs, you know, what's going on, Dulles, as both the director of the CIA and as MJ-1, circulates a set of draft directives, and there are eight directives that are basically sent out to a select group of the MJ-12 committee, and these directives are basically saying that Kennedy is making inquiries into the whole phenomenon. He is threatening our operations, and is a setup to kind of deal with the present situation. And so the directives include one, which is called Project Environment, which is a cryptic assassination directive. It quite clearly alludes to when the environment in Washington is non-conducive to growth, the conditions are suitable. Then the conditions are wet. I can't remember the exact phrasing of that, but basically it's a cryptic reference to anyone threatening Majestic 12 operations can be assassinated, and that pertains to any public official, no matter how high. There's no restriction there. So these eight directives are basically approved, and later on they're leaked, and they are directly implicated in the assassination of Kennedy. And I can talk about that maybe a little bit later, but certainly this is something that Alan Dulles set in place in 1961, in that period when he was still CIA director, but he was on his way out, and Kennedy was pressuring him to allow Kennedy access to all of these classified UFO files, mm-hmm. but Dulles wasn't allowing that.
And just one more interesting kind of tie into the official record is that in February of 61, so this is right after he's inaugurated, Kennedy sent out, what was it, like a national security memorandum or something, basically trying to regain full like administration control of psychological operations, because prior to this point, we'd seen this kind of drift away from executive control for psychological operations. So Kennedy, like officially right at the beginning of his administration, was trying to regain full control of kind of the entire foreign entire psychological operation policy. And so, and then that directly ties into the documents that you're talking about, the leaked documents, where the main subject of them all is psychological operations and how those relate to MJ-12. So I just thought that was an interesting kind of development right from the beginning of the administration. You have this memorandum, and then that goes into operation, and then a month or two later, there's this leaked memo from Kennedy to Dulles asking for all the information on MJ-12 psychological operations, and then by October, Dulles sends out this other document as a response to Kennedy, to, you know, this subcommittee of MJ-12, and then Dulles is officially, you know, fired and leaves. But as we know from just the history of Dulles, he, even though he was fired and left the CIA, he was still very much involved in the CIA and was pretty much running it, you know, from his office in his home. He didn't really leave the organization.
Right. Well, you know, even though Dulles was replaced by John McCone, that didn't mean that McCone became MJ1, that Dulles still would have kept that position. And, you know, as to when he gave up that position, we don't know. But certainly, I think given the threat Kennedy presented to the Majestic 12 Committee operations, that you know, Dulles would have stayed around for some time. Because it was all really the key person in the CIA that was kind of like the person that would monitor everything that was going on and implement these kinds of directives was James Jesus Angleton, who was the CIA's counterintelligence chief. Because within the CIA, you know, the two primary organizations that were always involved in this kind of extraterrestrial phenomenon and in the psychological operations that were presented as that were created as the cover for this, that, you know, or within the bureaucracy, psychological operations was always the cover for these deeper programs, these more highly classified extraterrestrial related projects, that you had the CIA's clandestine services division. Richard Bissell, he was the guy that was in charge of that. He was the one that flew out to Area 51 with the head of Lockheed's Skunk Works to basically set up Area 51. And you had James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of counterintelligence for the CIA. So these were the guys that were basically in charge of you know, all of these clandestine programs, psychological operations. So, you know, as you mentioned, you know, that Kennedy did try from the very beginning to get control over these psychological operations, because he knew that was the cover program for these deeper ET-related programs. And so if he was going to get any access to these deeper projects, then he needed to get in control of the psychological operations cover programs. And, you know, he only really had limited success.
Well, you know, like earlier in the show, Harrison mentioned that Kennedy's connection to Forrestal kind of jumped out from the pages of the book. Alan Dulles's connection to MJ-12 and being the number one jumped out to me as well. In recent years, we have been with books like the Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot and other books and investigations. We've learned that Dulles, in his position as head of CIA, had also kind of implemented MK-Ultra mind control programs.
He was
kind of devising all kinds of coups in Guatemala. Iran was one of the engineers of the Bay of Pigs invasion. There were all sorts of kind of deep state imperial projects that were, if not his brainchild, then things that he had a heavy hand in helping to bring about, not to mention his stories of manipulation and being conniving and supporting Nazis in Europe long after World War II to implement his counterintelligence programs. So in Dulles, we had a very very special, a very kind of virulent monstrous psychopath in the guise of this gentleman spy, as one author kindly described him. And it seems like he was Kennedy's kind of arch nemesis. He was standing for and believed in everything that Kennedy didn't. You know, it seems that he was this kind of incredible force for destruction and exploitation, and that he would also be head of MJ-12. I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise considering the amount of power he wielded, but it's like he had his hands in everything.
He did indeed, and you know, one of the things about Dulles is that His connection to the Nazi regime was a very old one. He, in fact, in 1933, was actually involved in Hitler being appointed chancellor by President Hindenburg, that that both Dulles brothers were actually working for a high-powered company, an attorney's firm called Sullivan and Cromwell, and that they represented a number of German industrialists corporations, and these industrialists wanted Hitler to be appointed chancellor because they recognized that he would be good for business. And so Dulles was involved in that from the very beginning. He was involved in many U.S. corporations going over to Nazi Germany, helping the rearmament program. Of course, you have the Second World War. Dulles is now head of the Office of Strategic Services out of Bern, Switzerland, and now Dulles is making all of these deals with these Nazis as the war is coming to an end and they realize they're going to lose. So Dulles is the one that facilitates all these deals. Agreements are made. The Germans establish an outpost in the southern hemisphere, or several outposts down there. And so Dulles was involved in all of that. And during the 1950s, during the Eisenhower administration, you know, with Operation Paperclip, you know, I think it is worth talking about a Fourth Reich, you know, because this was something that Martin Bormann had set up, you know, during the Second World War towards the very end, that a lot of the Nazi loot would be taken out of Germany before the collapse, and that would help set up Germany as an economic empire, as a Fourth Reich, but through economic means. And that was the new master plan, or this is the new plan, and Dulles was involved in that from the very beginning. And we can see through the 50s and the 60s just the inordinate power that the Operation Paperclip scientists had was amazing. I mean, you had Wernher von Braun, former SS officer, being the head of the Redstone missile range, and then being head of the Marshall Space Center. You had Kurt De Bus, also a former Nazi SS official, being head of the Kennedy Space Center. You know, a whole succession of Nazi officials, former Nazi officials that were Operation Paperclip scientists, went on to become senior officials within the military-industrial complex. You know, we're talking thousands of these people, and essentially what you have is the Fourth Reich kind of like having infiltrated the United States at a very in a very pervasive and covert manner, and that Dulles and the CIA were very much involved in all of that. And this is one of the things about Kennedy. I think Kennedy's father, Joe Kennedy, was a supporter of Hitler. He actually had supported the Nazi regime even after the after the Second World War began, and he was sacked as ambassador to Britain. Joseph Kennedy actually made a donation to the Nazi Party, so he was a big believer in Nazism. And I think that what happened was that the Fourth Reich actually supported John F. Kennedy being elected president. They didn't trust Nixon. They didn't trust Eisenhower. So they supported Kennedy because they thought Kennedy could be controlled because Joe Kennedy, had so much influence over his son. What happened was that shortly after Kennedy gets elected, Joe Kennedy suffers a stroke, and so he becomes he has no real influence over his sons. And so both the mafia and the Fourth Reich feel that the Kennedys have gone rogue. And so this is where I think Dulles started to really kind of like become an enemy of the Kennedy administration.
You spoke in your book a little bit about two meetings that Kennedy has with Eisenhower shortly before he's inaugurated in 61, I think it is. By then, I guess Eisenhower became resigned to having limited knowledge of what was going on in S4. And Kennedy is kind of gearing himself up for what he needs to do as president, what he wants to do, what he knows. And so you speculate in your book that Eisenhower shared some of his views on what was going on with Kennedy. Can you say why you think they had that conversation and what you believe was might have been communicated to Kennedy?
Sure. Well, we know that Kennedy actually did meet Eisenhower twice before becoming president, while he was president-elect, and that there was some private time for both of them. And I basically speculate in the book, given what Eisenhower had said in his farewell address, that he almost certainly would have given Kennedy more details into what exactly it was about the military-industrial complex that was a threat to American liberties, because certainly in the farewell address he kind of describes this threat in very kind of general terms. So I think it's very reasonable to assume that Eisenhower would have been more specific in these private meetings with Kennedy about the nature of this threat that the military-industrial complex played. And this is where, we come into this whole question about MJ-12, the CIA being in charge of kind of running the psychological warfare operations that were a cover for these ET-related projects, and the whole kind of Nazi connection as well, that's also a factor here. And so I think this is what Kennedy was told or given a kind of briefing by Eisenhower, and maybe given some idea in terms of how to kind of approach this problem, because I think Eisenhower was a real kind of patriot, American patriot, and I think he would have gone beyond the idea that, well, I'm a Republican and Kennedy's a Democrat, so I'm not going to tell him everything I know. I think he would have really seen this threat as something that pertained to the entire political class, respective of their, partisan leanings. And so I think he would have told Kennedy everything he knew and given Kennedy some advice on how to deal with this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can move on to an interesting chapter in the book regarding Marilyn Monroe. And maybe I'll just leave it at that. Can you tell us the story of how Marilyn Monroe fits into all this?
Right. Well, Marilyn Monroe was a lover of John F. Kennedy, and basically what happened was that at a certain point, J. Edgar Hoover made it clear that Marilyn Monroe was a security threat because she had friends that were associated with Cuba and the communist movement, and that Kennedy, in pillow talk with Monroe, may have been revealing some classified information that was a threat. It was a national security threat. So Kennedy was warned off Monroe, and Robert Kennedy, his brother, was the one that kind of like had to pass on the bad news to Marilyn Monroe, but he then gets involved with Marilyn Monroe, and so the same thing happens. Then at a certain point, J. Edgar Hoover contacts Robert Kennedy and tells him, you got to stop your liaisons with Marilyn Monroe. She's a security threat because of her communist leanings. And so this is what set off the final kind of confrontation with Marilyn Monroe, because she knew about some of Kennedy's visits to these facilities where they actually housed extraterrestrial craft, and even one of the bodies of one of the extraterrestrials. And so he said this to Monroe, and Monroe had talked about it to Dorothy Kilgannon, who was a very well-known correspondent at the time. And so what Monroe didn't know was that the CIA was actually doing wiretaps of her. And so basically everything Monroe was saying on the phone was being tapped by the CIA, and that in particular there was one CIA document that actually that is a transcript or a summary of a wiretapping that occurred just several days before Monroe was killed, that basically said that Monroe was threatening to hold a press conference where she would reveal all of the secrets, that she had a red diary where all of the information was contained, and that this document actually had the signature of James Jesus Angleton on there. So he's the CIA counterintelligence chief. So he's part of the monitoring of Monroe, who was about to spill the beans about what Kennedy had told her about the UFO phenomenon. And then, of course, we have the actual death of Monroe. I think, what was it, early August of 1962. Robert Kennedy visits her house twice on that same day, where she's killed. And during the evening, there are eyewitnesses. Monroe's housekeeper and the groundsman both see Robert Kennedy having a confrontation with Monroe, demanding the diary, and Monroe refused, and then that's where you have the stories of Robert Kennedy being involved in a some way with the assassination, because one of the agents that were accompanying him during the second visit on the evening of, I think it was August 2nd, something like that, that he administered some drug to her and that incapacitated her. And then later on, Monroe is dead. So, Robert Kennedy is directly implicated. In the book, I speculate that Kennedy probably didn't realize that, if the doctor that was accompanying him had administered a lethal dosage, that Kennedy wouldn't have known that, that maybe he was being set up, or maybe that after he and his two agents left, another team came in and administered the lethal dosage. But nevertheless, Robert Kennedy was implicated in the death of Marilyn Monroe. So this could be later used against him as blackmail. The important thing I think to keep in mind is that the death of Marilyn Monroe, you actually have this connection with James Angleton, whose name was mentioned on this wiretap, that he was monitoring what she was saying and that she was a security threat. So you actually have this CIA connection with there. And that's important later on when we get to talk about the Bern memo of the Majestic 12 directive that was implicated in President Kennedy's assassination.
Well, so Monroe basically felt jilted by JFK and was threatening to go public in some way about the things that he shared with her about the reality of UFOs and extraterrestrial bodies. And that would have destroyed his presidency and any chance he would have had of getting a hold on the whole subject and helping to steer the control of the extraterrestrial connection towards a more constructive end. We know that Kennedy was in great touch with the Soviet Union's premier, Nikita Khrushchev. They had a correspondence going. They met in Geneva to have informal discussions. They both showed a willingness to work together and to dampen the Cold War kind of animosity and fear and paranoia and aggression that was being kind of propagated by both countries, but mostly the U.S., mostly by Dulles and people in his circles. And so Kennedy tries to do a very interesting thing, you write, in kind of sidestepping or circumventing the control that the CIA has on this whole subject. And what he does is he proposes, you write, to create a kind of joint space program with Russia. And at first, Khrushchev kind of demurs and says he doesn't think it's a good idea. But then he comes back and he says, he is open to it. So I wonder, Michael, if you can get into that a little bit, what Kennedy was doing in using its his kind of overtures towards Russia in getting at more information from his own CIA and other organizations.
Right. Well, yes, that was really the key policy that Kennedy had started pursuing in 1963. That I think is directly related to why he was actually assassinated. That Kennedy had basically been frustrated in trying to get the CIA to divulge the classified UFO material that he was wanting. And so he decided that he would do this end run where he would cooperate with the Soviet Union. And as a result of the cooperative agreements with the Soviet Union in a joint space program, that anything pertinent to space and UFO, classified UFO reports would be part of that, would be equally shared by the Russians and the American space agencies. And so this basically was a means whereby the one branch of the US bureaucracy, and we're talking about the NASA and the State Department, could demand from the CIA access to these classified UFO files, because now they need to share these with the Russians or with the Soviet Union, and they would also get what the Soviet Union had. So there was a way now to kind of like cross-reference what was going on when it came to this UFO phenomenon, from the Soviet perspective and the American perspective. And this was how Kennedy, I believe, really thought that he could basically have all of the relevant issues pertaining to UFOs, extraterrestrial life, and so forth. Basically that information being given access to a lot of the best and the brightest in the U.S., kind of national security system, so that the best policies could be reached. So that was the strategy, and it was proposed in September at the United Nations. Khrushchev demurs up until November. And November 11, 1963, the Soviets have experienced one of their rocket tests fails. And so that was the catalyst for Khrushchev then saying, well, we need to cooperate with the Americans now. That's how he could justify to his kind of military industrial complex, or to the Communist Party, why cooperation with the Americans was essential. And so now he accepted Kennedy's offer. And so on November 12, you actually have Kennedy sending off National Security Action Memorandum 271, which is an official document that basically instructs the head, the NASA administrator, James Webb, to share all relevant information with the Soviet Union's space program, because now the US and the USSR are going to be cooperating in a joint space program, and they would have a joint mission to the moon. This was now part of the official record. On the same day, you actually have Kennedy sending off a top secret memorandum, which has never been officially released. This is a leaked Majestic document, which is directed to John McCone, who is the new CIA director, basically ordering McCone to share all classified UFO files with NASA and the State Department, because now NASA is obliged to share all such files with the Soviet Union as spelt out in National Security Action Memorandum 271. So now McCone is given these orders. And McCone, even though he's CIA director, it's like he doesn't have access to the CIA files, to the classified UFO files. It's still Dulles who has access to these, or Angleton who has access. And so in the document itself, in this top secret memorandum, there's some handwriting there whereby the William Colby, who's in charge of the CIA operations in Vietnam at the time, and the CIA were doing a lot of things in Vietnam that were also relevant to this issue. Colby basically, in his handwriting, says that Angleton has MJ directives, and that's very important because that, you know, that was signed on November 19. So this is only like 3 days before Kennedy's assassination, where Colby is saying that in response to Kennedy's order for McCone to share these classified UFO files, Colby is basically saying to McCone, he's saying, "Oh, don't worry about it. Angleton has the MJ-12 directives. He knows how to respond to this." And of course, you know, 2-3 days later, Kennedy is dead in Dulles.
Well, maybe do we want to move on to the burned memo and the things you were planning on saying about that?
Sure, because this is you know, this is the smoking gun document, this leaked Majestic document with Angleton being referred to as having these MJ-12 directives. This pertains to the burned memo, which was something that had earlier been drafted by Dulles, as I talked about a little bit earlier, and the memo, the directive, the Majestic directive that is directly relevant to this is the Project Environment, and that's the one that spells out that, you know, when the environment in Washington is not conducive to growth, that it should be wet, something along those lines. And, you know, the term "it should be wet" is an assassination directive, a cryptic reference to assassination, because wet works is how the intelligence community refers to kind of like assassination plans that the Russian intelligence service during Tsarist times was the first to start referring, using this kind of euphemism of, you know, wet, you know, it should be wet, or wet works, in describing assassinations of people. And so here you have this MJ-12 directive cryptically authorizing assassination against any senior political official, and that this is what is actually referred to in this top secret memorandum that was addressed to John McCone by President Kennedy to share all classified UFO files with NASA, that rather than following through on Kennedy's order to share the classified files, that McCone was being told by William Colby, who in his own handwriting was basically saying, "It's okay, don't worry about it. This is going to be looked after by Angleton, who has the MJ-12 directive."
Very interesting.
Well, I find it fascinating that here we are 60 years later or so, and you know, the same deep state or secret government that was trying to prevent Kennedy from not only finding out or sharing information about the existence of UFOs and aliens and what they were doing here, but was trying to create a constructive relationship that wasn't based on war, that wasn't based on aggression and intervention around the world, that Kennedy was trying to establish some kind of normal healthy relationship with Russia. And here we are again, 70 years later, and reading about the outrageous accusations and demonization of Russia even now. And it kind of suggests in some way that many of the same, at least the same types of thinking that were involved in the Kennedy assassination is alive and well all these decades later. And I don't know if you want to comment on that or not, Michael.
That is a very important point, and I think it really was an effort by people both within the Soviet Union and the United States at that time that Kennedy was wanting to promote relations, positive relations, because this was the way in which control over these secretive projects could be shared more widely amongst the bureaucracy. And certainly I think developing positive relations with the Soviet Union and ending the Cold War, because this is clearly what would have happened, and quite correct that this would have ended the Cold War. Joint missions to the moon and space cooperation would have brought that to an end. But of course, the deep state, it relies on international conflict in order to be able to raise huge amounts of black budget funds to basically fund these classified programs that pertain to extraterrestrial life and technologies, and not share that with the kind of rest of the US bureaucracy, and kind of like keep it in the hands of core group of industrialists and national elites that are all part of this kind of deep state. And that the same thing is happening now, that we actually have a president who wanted to set up positive relationship with Russia, and that those attempts have been stymied. Russia is now being publicly vilified, and a new Cold War is being justified by deep space assets. And of course, we have lots of rumors now and about Trump being assassinated, and so this definitely there's a connection here with what happened to Kennedy and what Trump is trying to do with positive relationships with Russia, because I think he has been advised that through a positive relationship with Russia, a lot of these secrets can be revealed. But in without that, then it's going to be kind of war and distraction.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, just on a humorous note, I just had a flash image in my mind of Trump tweeting about aliens and UFOs. That would be the day.
That would be disclosure, wouldn't it?
of some kind or another, for sure.
But then he might deny. He might deny it later. You never know.
Well, but I think that's why he is such a threat. Yeah. That he could just do it through a tweet, just like that. Mm-hmm. Just yes, this is real. This is happening. ETs are here, and they're covering it up. And that, ball games are over. Really, I don't think they could ever put the genie back in the bottle.
Well, they might put Trump in a mental institute, but who knows?
On that note, Michael. A real pleasure talking to you today. We really appreciate you coming on. Again, Michael Sala's book is Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower, UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's Assassination. Really makes a pretty good argument. I wouldn't say that the UFO disclosure and the kind of detente to Russia were the only reasons. Certainly he had other things on his agenda. Kennedy wanted to do a lot to reform the U.S. Economically, socially, culturally. But certainly this plays a significant piece of the puzzle. Of that, I don't think we can question. The other article, if you want to check it out, it's quite good. if I can get it here, it's Eisenhower's 1954 meeting with extraterrestrials, which can be found on exopolitics.com. And Michael, thank you so much.
Well, I just wanted to, a minor correction there. My website actually is exopolitics.org.
.org, sorry about that.
No problem. So I want to thank you, Ellen and Harrison, for the great questions. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, and this is the 100th anniversary of Kennedy's birth. So it's appropriate that we kind of discuss this this year. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll end it there.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everyone. And tune in next week as we bring you another show next Sunday. The Health and Wellness Show next Friday. And take care, everyone.
All right. Take care.